dead at all.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is March 22nd, 2011, and this is episode 452. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always make the mainstream news, the kinds of things that are frequently labeled as alternative or paranormal. For the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email it to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. Send it through the virtual auditorium on Pal Talks by text is another way to get those questions to me. I do monitor the email during the program, and if you're listening outside the virtual auditorium and would like to have a question answered, go ahead, email it to me and I'll get it asked for you. In the virtual auditorium, just put it into text and I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. And if I don't catch it the first time, feel free to repeat it again. For those of you who are listening in on a podcast, please go ahead and email me as well. I'll try and get your questions answered too. And if you really want to get in on the air, you can dial in at 504-273-7379. Once again, that number is 504-273-7379. For those of you who like to feel connected, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter, so you can link to me there. There's also a Dawn of Shades fan page on Facebook, so you can look for that as well. For the readers, campers, and foodies, check out the articles and blogs. You can find some material that just might interest you. Now, for tonight's program, it is the second half of a series that started on The Voice of the People, hosted by Greg Miller on Saturday, and features a group of speakers. Tonight we're joined by Joe Montaldo, November Hansen, Jason Wilson, Greg Miller, and myself. Now, if the great technical muses smile upon our heads, we will have a fantastic show tonight as we carry on with the topic we embarked on Saturday evening. Now, we're going to start off and have everybody introduce themselves. Joe Montaldo, you're the first one in the hot seat, so would you introduce yourself to the audience and let them know who you are?
Well, hello, everyone. Gia said I can only have minutes, so it's going to be fast. I can't talk. No, I'm just teasing. I'm Joe Montaldo, International Director for the International Community for Alien Research, host of UFO Undercover, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, and basically a 30-year researcher in the field in the advanced study of alien abduction research. It's really the only thing I even look at anymore. That, ancient history, and alien agendas is pretty much is what I focus on these days. But I got to say, I enjoy doing this. I have a lot of fun. I always like coming on and doing these panel shows because they're always a lot of fun. And, guys, it's easy to find me, www.icall1.com, paranormalradionetwork.com, or you can reach me at upn@cox.net or ical@cox.net. All right, who's next?
Next in the hot seat is going to be Jason Wilson. Jason, you want to tell everybody who you are?
Why, certainly. Hello, everybody. I'm Jason Wilson. I'm the Texas State Director for ICAR, Joe's baby. Actually, it's all of our – it's a kind of a creation of – well, I guess you could say a lot of us on the panel are guilty of a bad organization coming around. And in a nutshell, I've been taking a look at the alien abduction phenomenon for about a dozen years or so.
Okay, and next in the hot seat is going to be Greg Miller. You want to tell everybody who you are?
Yeah, as soon as I could get my microphone unmuted there, I'm sorry, we're looking at a couple of different windows. I'm Greg Miller, host of Voice of the People on Saturday nights on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And it's a pleasure to have everybody back here for the second part of this panel. I look forward to being a little bit more of an active participant with it tonight. And also, I would like to throw a plug out for anybody that's listening that cares. You can go to my website at wgrm.tk, and you'll find some information on a group that I'm working with called Help Help Philippines. We are putting together an effort to put toys, shoes, clothes, and school supplies together for some kids in some very, very deprived conditions overseas, and we could appreciate your help.
Okay, and the next one in the hot seat is going to be November Hansen. You want to introduce yourself and let the audience know who you are?
Hello, everybody. I'm November Hansen, former host of Voice of the People Radio. I retired from that program because I wanted to do more work with research on ICAR. That was only part of the reason why I wanted to retire. I also have aging parents. I'm finding myself that middle generation, and I wanted to have the opportunity to spend more time with them. And just working on research projects is going to allow me to do that. So I've been a part of the UFO community for 12 years. I have always been interested in the subject, and I am not an NSA agent. Thank you very much.
And, of course, there's myself, and if you don't know who I am, check out our website at www.exogenynetwork.com. Okay, folks, I'm going to start off with a new question tonight. We're going to do it a little bit different.
That's what you get for calling me an NSA agent.
I know what happened.
They don't like it when you go off the reservation.
We lost you and Greg, I think. Greg, you there? We lost you and Greg, huh?
I'm still here.
Okay, hold on, we just lost you.
So do you want me to continue on while we're waiting for Gia to get back,
yeah,
and then she can
go,
just pop me in the head?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and I'm going to get her back.
Because I have something I can bring up, guys, while we're waiting for Gia to come back. I just ran across this a couple days ago. Many years ago, we started terminology in the UFO field just because we found that there wasn't enough sophisticated language or language to adequately describe an experience. One of those terminologies that we started was downloads. I was reading an article on a major news network about Sammy Hagar, I believe is his name, who's written a personal biography, and in his biography he talks about his own experiences and uses the term downloads. I thought that was interesting how over 12 years that particular terminology has infiltrated the community.
Well, I think that it's really interesting that we could coin a phrase in a chat room and, you know, years later you find the media picking it up. But what I find more interesting than that are people that are experiencers that come up and tell me that they're, you know, on several occasions been downloaded too.
You see, that's the thing, though. Was it 10 years ago? What are we, in 2000? I think it was 2001, somewhere around there. That's what ICAR actually, and this was one of the first things that ever broke, was the fact that downloads were part of alien abductions. Now it's part of the field, but it wasn't before that. That's something we actually did. Well, actually, the whole group did. It's not just ICAR, the whole bunch of us did. There were so many people that were pushing at the same time for all that different stuff. And you got a group as big as ours, it tends to get out fast. Well, and gee, ladies and gentlemen, if y'all are listening to us right now, since you don't want to answer the type.
This is what happens when we have drop calls.
I know.
There I am, back again.
Yes.
Okay, guys, now that I'm back and I'm going to stick around, I wanted to do things a little bit differently tonight. I'm going to start off with asking you guys each a new question, and I want you to tell the audience about your dream event in ufology, something that you would love to see arranged and why you think it would provide the maximum benefit for ufology in general. Now, Joe, as one of the louder voices in ufology, we're going to stick you in the hot seat first.
Thank you for that. Well, you know, actually, this is something I've been advocating for a while now. A couple things, but more importantly, I have been wanting to see some type of group set together inside the field, its own little peer group, its own little committee, whatever you want to call it, something that will allow for all of our Facebook friends and our MySpace friends and our Twitter friends and all of our Internet friends to have a valuable resource. Because right now, ICAR provides a lot of information, but we're one of many organizations in the field, and there are literally hundreds of people writing stuff every day, and there's no oversight whatsoever. So if you're Joe Internet and you come home, you say, you know what, I'm going to type in the acronym UFO. Oh, my God, you don't even know what you just got yourself into. And Lord help you if you type in paranormal. So we really need a group that stuff can be submitted to, and they can put their rubber seal on and say, yeah, we like it, yeah, we don't like it, whatever. At least it would help to get rid of some of the BS. I mean, we're never going to get rid of the BS because the Internet is an open source place and you can put whatever you want on it. But at least this way, you know, you get 10 or 15 of the bigger name ufologists together and you send them out a letter and say, hey, look, this came in. We would like to see what y'all think about this. And you could even do it like that. You can say, well, these 10 ufologists said, yeah, these 5 didn't. But at least there's a guideline for some type of legitimate research because, frankly, right now, that's one of the biggest gripes I get from anybody who gets into the field. They're like, well, how do you know who's telling the truth? Well, that's the big question, is it? Who is telling the truth? So you really need a group of ufologists to sign off on it. By the way, to the person who just sent me that, I know I don't want to be on the board at all. I was thinking one of our other directors, to be honest with you. Yeah, because I wouldn't be good at that. I'm not patient enough for that kind of stuff. But one of our other directors would be good. But really, it is something I really am passionate about. It's something I've been seeing for a while, that the field does need oversight. And more importantly, there is no legitimate study in any area of science that doesn't have peer oversight. None. If you want to be legitimate, you have to have oversight. There has to be rules, guidelines, regulations, you know, something to adhere to, because right now, frankly, it's insane. And I don't even mind. I mean, I'm willing to submit my own work and even ICAR's work to these people and have them review it and look at it. So, I mean, we're willing to do it. We're even willing to help out with the people, but at this point, something's got to be done. Because I don't want to spend another 20 years just racking up information for the sake of racking up information, but I'm going to shut up after that. It'll be good.
Okay. Well, November, you are up next to tell us what your dream event would be.
My dream event? Explain the question.
And why? You think it would be what it would provide benefits for ufology?
Oh my gosh! dream event. You know, I just like to see a lot of different fields come together. I'd like to see the type of research projects that are being done expanded, integrated. I'd like to see them reviewed, peer reviewed, even, you know, people of science taking a look at it, saying, you know what, there's no way this is possible. Maybe. Or you're even offering the comment, you know what, there is some plausibility here. Let's take a little bit, you know, deeper look into it. Or finding connections in other areas. You might be working on a research project like Joe's blood study, but it might also have something to do with the personality study or even the reptilian study, because that particular study is showing something significant as far as blood types go, as whereas when I did the gray study, it didn't really show anything significant in that particular area. So, you know, to expand them to include more of the world population, I guess, and to have the people, you know, that are willing to do the work and gather the information. I mean, when you talk about doing a study, it's not sitting down, creating a questionnaire and saying, okay, all I got to do is collect all the information. Once you get all the information, you have to start looking at all kinds of different things. You might be digging into ancient history. You might be looking at modern medicine. You might be looking at, you know, various different fields of science. And you need to have the time to sit there and read all that stuff and see if there's some kind of connection. And then you also need somebody to look at it to see if they're seeing the same thing you do. So in my dream world, that is the type of study I would see going on in ufology, and not just these collections of ideas from various different sources. And then each of those sources, you know, producing them as if that is it, and that's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Jason, I'm going to slap you in the hot seat now. Can you tell us what your dream event in ufology would be and why you would think it provides the maximum benefit for ufology in general?
Well, I guess I could always sit here and say that I'd like to see President Obama hold a press conference and show up with the Roswell aliens, but I really don't think that's ever going to happen. Tamir, Joe, and November's points, I think they're pretty much exactly right, and they sort of stole a little bit of my thunder. I mean, there is an awful lot of information of varying quality from a lot of different sources out there, and I'd have to say from personal experience, I have come across an awful lot of contactees that I've gotten a hold of, and I'm sure you guys have had similar experiences where, you know, the contactee that you're talking to is basically disgusted with a lot of the venues that they went to try to find somebody to help them figure out what was happening or even just looking to talk to somebody. I mean, a lot of these people go to, you know, air out their experiences, try to see if anybody else has had anything like that, and the next thing you know, you basically got somebody pushing some type of channeling cult down their throat, and they really don't like it. I guess if I had to pick a definitive answer, I'd have to side somewhere along the lines with November that I would really like to see, well, another, genuine scientist, genuinely accredited researcher along the lines of John Mack, you know, take some of the studies that we've done, you know, and take some of the traits of contactees in general and actually, you know, do a good peer-reviewed study and, you know, just something that the rest of the psychological, medical, or any other field gets to take a look at.
Okay. That's great. And, Greg, it is now your chance to tell us about your dream event and why you think it would provide the maximum benefit for ufology in general.
Well, I'll go Jason one better. In my dream world, you know, I'm the one that's going to take you on the White House lawn to talk to President Obama with some ETs in tow. But beyond all that, what I would like to actually see is I would like to see a real disclosure of information under the Freedom of Information Act for things that the government may consider a little too touchy. And I would also like to see the president issue an executive order granting amnesty to people who have been sworn to issues of national security that have been cleared and have no idea that the material that they're covering has been declassified. I would think that a lot more people that are advancing in age would probably have the opportunity to share some of their information with the investigators that they otherwise haven't been able to disclose because, you know, they were bullied and basically told that there was going to be a problem if they said anything.
Okay. Listening to you guys, you know, I can easily see where, you know, if I tell you about my dream event would essentially be like an invitational convention, but without the audience. You simply bring together the various people that head up organizations, all these key people that are players in the ufology field, put them together in a room and say, okay, you guys come up with something cooperative, or you can't leave. But the reality is we know we can't lock them up like that. So I can see where most of you are thinking, you know, the ideal event would be to get these VIPs together, especially away from the public eye, where they have to function without presenting their public persona, you might say, to come together, do some brainstorming, set up some cooperative efforts, compile, cooperate, and all those other things that just don't seem to be happening. It would be nice to see people actually cooperate and put the information together, because we seem to have segmented all the research that's being done in this area. You know, when you sit and you talk about all these people, how much do they actually have time to even sit down and talk about what's important? And I think that would be a great thing, and we're kind of all in the same ballpark in that the dream event would be essentially creating a real ufology conference or congress, and eventually creating that peer group that would do reviews of new material being released.
That's definitely needed. Mm. I don't know if you can get all the egos in one place without a roof blowing up there.
Maybe we have to equip the seats with straps so we can't have any stomping, kicking, biting, screaming, or smacking of our peers within the group, right?
I think we have to set up some type of TSA security system with some really good metal detectors before we let that group get together.
There are some really big egos in ufology. But I think part of it is you need to have that ego in order to withstand the really the negative press and the finger-pointing and the attempts to humiliate you, embarrass you, criticize, you know, ridicule you, and so forth and so on. If you don't have that ego, you cannot have a thick enough skin to stay in the field and remain a viable player.
Sure. That's definitely true, because these days it's tough. I got to say, the egos are better now, I noticed, in the last 10 years than they were prior. A lot of the new ufologists, the new breed of ufologists, I like to call them, they still have big egos, mind you. I don't want anybody to get the wrong idea, but they seem to have a better handle on them, like our predecessors had. But still, there's a lot of work needed there.
Well, I think that
it would be nice to see more cooperation, I'll admit. Gregory, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would think that just a group of people getting together, like Joe keeps bringing up, with a peer review system. And when we get down to it, I mean, most people aren't going to pay any attention to something unless it is a physical chain of evidence. So if we could at least start with a peer review system on physical evidence that has been submitted to places like the National UFO Reporting Center receives things in different packages, and you have people out there like Dr. Lear that work on these implants, and if we could actually get, you know, some serious PhDs who, you know, wouldn't be worried about dragging their name through the muck in academic circles, you know, if there was generally a sense of amnesty on the subject matter, then we would be able to proceed with something like that. And I think until people's attitudes in general change towards scoffing at something that they don't want to understand, we're not going to see a peer review process come forward.
Well, but see, that's a double-edged sword, because without the peer review process, you're not going to get rid of the scoffing. So it's kind of like a chicken and the egg. You know, one of them's got to come first, and unfortunately, if you want people to really get serious and really take this field serious, you've got to have reviewed evidence. I mean, that's what happened in psychology. Everybody forgets. Psychology was a pseudoscience. It really kind of still is borderline pseudoscience. But it was a pseudoscience for 100 years before it got peer-reviewed and got legitimacy and started having college programs to look at their stuff. I mean, that's how you get legitimate. But you can't get legitimate, you know, without some kind of formal review, because nobody's going to care. Even if you've got really good evidence, you're one person. And, you know, if the evidence isn't reviewed, everybody's going to fight about it. If it's reviewed, they're not going to fight about it as much. You know, it just makes everybody's life easy. So like I said, it's a chicken and egg. You know, you got to have both, but one of them's got to come first. And I don't know, it's pretty tough, Greg.
Well, I don't think that it could parallel psychology, because one of the things that psychologists is that the psychologist has to see another psychologist and be evaluated one-on-one at least once a year to make sure that they're not having a breakdown. And I don't think that we can actually do the same thing with ufologists, because then the ego thing gets in the way, so we then have another conundrum.
Well, you see, but that's kind of weird, because we kind of do that. It's hard to explain, but I'll give you an example right quick. The other day, I'm not going to mention their names, I'm talking to three or four different ufologists. They're all friends of mine, they all work in the field. We use each other's events, so in a way, we're already doing that in different groups. Even inside the ICO organization, we do that. You'll catch us in the room sometimes doing that. Everybody will get together, and everybody kind of vents sometimes, kind of therapy. But for us, it's different because we're already a much closer-knit group than psychology is. The people in the field are a much closer group. Everybody knows everybody. If you play any decent part in this field, you pretty much know everybody. Everybody pretty much knows you. So it's a little bit different in that aspect, and it's going to be a little closer knit, and it's going to be a little tighter. And, you know, I'm not going to mention some other friends of mine that happened to be in the station. I was just talking to you the other day about this. You know, it's support. We have our own structural support group. So we really do need something to look at the research, because we're already supporting each other. It's why we show up in conferences and groups. It's why we go visit with each other. If you ever go to UFO conference, you'll notice all the ufologists will have breakfast together or dinner together. They'll have drinks together, but they're always together, because it's our only time really to associate with each other and really sit down and talk with each other. So we already kind of got that. We just need real strong peer reviews. I've been doing this for
you know,
a long
I could
time.
See a real benefit, though, in all ufologists going through a review process by their peers, where they were both the reviewer and the reviewee, not at the same time, but at various points. Without mentioning any names, you know, we've all heard the stories of particular people involved in the field that seem to be focusing on dealing with abductees and their abductee children. And I know for me, when I'm reading this material from that particular person, warning flags are flying everywhere. It's really concerning to me, because as a parent, as a grandparent, as a former child myself even, you know, I'm reading this stuff and I'm going, ooh, boy, you know, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. And not all researchers and people involved in this field are necessarily without particular quirks of their own. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to be spreading that like a bad virus.
Be good to get some of
that is a good point. I mean, one of the things that we need to look at here is, you know, how to establish some type of a quality standard. Now, of course, the whole peer review idea is great, but it's always going to have its naysayers, because, quite honestly, not everybody is going to be invited to be on the review board. I mean, here at ICAR, we've had, you know, certain amounts of experience. Well, first off, one of the problems is what defines a ufologist. You know, technically somebody that's read a couple of books or watched a couple of YouTube videos or written a blog about it or something like that could, you know, consider themselves a serious ufologist. I mean, there's always going to be people with differing opinions that are more or less going to say the review board is crap, but, of course, I think, you know, that's one of the important things to do. Once we establish, you know, a set amount of quality standards, you know, we could leave it up to the individual to decide whether we're telling the truth or not. And from a lot of the experience that I've had, we seem to do a fairly good job of that here at ICAR. Most of the contactees we get most of the contactees that we talk to are, you know, fairly pleased with the amount of information and the type of interaction that we give them. Now, I can't say that everybody is. I mean, there have been, you know, more than a few instances where more or less we told somebody we completely and totally disagree with them, or their particular experiences, you know, aren't exactly relevant to my line of research. And, well, we've also had a couple of experiences where those same people have gone off and, you know, made up horrible rumors about us. ICAR is in charge of all of the military.
You know, I don't think the review board's job would be so much to establish the validity of a person's line of research, so much as to establish the validity of the person's tactics. Because, you know, I may think it's totally an absolute crock that anybody can channel aliens, or, you know, that it's possibly real. So I may regard anything involving that as stupid, yet the next 10 people might regard that as a very valid thread of research. But if we establish standards for, you might say, the methodology, or, you know, for how they're going to go about it, and the things that are ethical for them to do, is it really ethical to take kids and segregate them from mainstream population and drill them how to be good abductees? You know, to me, that looks a lot like pre-programming. I mean, you know, you're going to completely taint any possibility of reliable information from those kids. And is it fair to them? No, I don't think it's fair to them. They're not even old enough to make up their own mind yet. you know, personally, I really am dubious about minors, especially under, say, 14 or so, being involved actively in research beyond dealing with a particular investigator. You know, do we want them at conferences? Do we want them being speakers? You know, I question whether it's good for the child as well as whether or not that information is being presented accurately.
Oh, most definitely. And in certain cases, it can be, you know, completely and totally dangerous to take somebody that's that young and that impressionable and, you know, basically force somebody's dogma on them. I mean, if these people get involved, you know, with somebody out there trying to create a cult of personality or something like that, I mean, we've seen cases in the past where, who knows, these children might wait for the next comet to fly by, tie their Nikes up, drink some of the Kool-Aid, and catch a ride home.
No, yeah, exactly. We don't need that kind of, you know, so I have concerns anytime anybody is really working intensely with the kids. Now, I can see reasons why a researcher would take a group of these kids, put them in a situation to observe them, to see what do they do different than this group of kids that's a control group with no experiences at all. Do they interact differently? Do they have different interests? Are they different in terms of maturity and growth and whatnot? Are they personality? You know, that kind of research I can see. But taking these kids to indoctrinate them with somebody's ufology dogma, that's kind of bizarre.
No, that sounds like absolute programming to me. And my personal policy is I leave anybody that's under the age of 18 completely and totally alone. I mean, even if I do have parental consent, the most I will do is, you know, listen to accounts that a minor might have today. But, I mean, in no way am I about to begin explaining things to them or start to tell them what to expect or anything like that. I mean, that's just bad karma right there.
I'm going to agree
Go ahead, November.
Well, I don't think that the children should necessarily be involved with research. I believe really that should come from home. That should be a parental decision. And, I mean, I'm of the view that if a child asks a question, answer them. Answer them honestly with an answer that is appropriate for their age level. You know, if you start talking about something that they can't possibly comprehend, then trying to give them an answer isn't going to work very well. But there are always answers to a child's questions appropriate for their age level. And then instead of telling them, well, this is it, say, this is what I think it might be. Because if you really don't know yourself, how can you possibly tell a child that this is what's happening? And give them the opportunity to grow into it and ask their own questions, you know, with the acceptability of being able to ask those questions. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, in general, I tend to agree with you. Now, there are times and places where, to a certain level of research, but there again, it has to be with parental permission, obviously, they are relevant. I mean, RFP children maturing differently. You know, we've all read all this stuff about these indigo kids, and we're hearing how star children are supposed to be so much faster, brighter, smarter, et cetera. Where's this research coming from? I mean, who's determining who these kids are or aren't? You know, when we look at our own children, grandchildren, et cetera, and we're experiences ourselves and our offspring are, and possibly our grandchildren are, you know, how much do you talk about? I know what tactic I've taken. And my tactic was that when they were little and they asked questions, I would respond with a question, you know, typically, you know, vague manner, so that I didn't influence what their perception of the situation was. I said, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not giving them feedback as to how they should feel about it. You know, I would say, well, that's really interesting, you know. And then I would go off and think about it, you know, after they would tell me about the spaceships and the spacemen landing in the yard and whatnot. Did I say, oh, that's aliens and we were abducted? No. I said, oh, that's interesting, and I went about the day. And so they regarded it as somewhat normal. Would I have been willing to let a researcher talk to them? Probably not. You know, it was a long time before I was willing to talk about it much with a researcher. So, you know, would I take a different tactic? No. Am I going to talk about it with my granddaughter? Probably not. You know, it's just that that's the way I feel about it. I don't know if men tend to be differently about it or not. But in general, I found that I just really don't want to influence them. I want them to grow up with their own opinion.
Well, I have a remark to make here. I mean, I looked just the other day on all the social network stuff that pops up on my computer, and there's a little 11-year-old boy that had a near-death experience. And, you know, sure enough, that's like one of the main headlines. We have all this stuff going on with the Libyan people, excuse me, everyone, and here this, you know, is mainstream news. And you have people coming at it from 15 different angles, and the thing that is being overlooked is the fact that it's an 11-year-old boy that's giving this, you know, firsthand testimony of his NDE. And you have to wonder, in today's age, if, you know, 5-10 years from now, this 11-year-old boy isn't going to be hooked onto a social networking site, and I won't mention any of them by name, but, and then openly mocked. You have to look at the same thing and apply that to ufology. Now, be careful here. I'm not comparing ufology to any religion, but the premise on which, you know, they were basing all the news articles and everything with the boy with the near-death experience was that, you know, for all intents and purposes, his firsthand experience happened to relate a lot of religious, you know, portions to it, and I'll just leave that at that.
Yeah, you know, there's always a debate of how much consideration a child experience, or whether it's, you know, no matter what kind of paranormal event it is, how much should public exposure is good for them. But in general, it sounds like we're all kind of the same mind that information from a child under 18 is to be collected carefully, and only with parental permission. It's kind of what I'm getting from everybody. How about you, Joe?
Oh, yeah. There's you know, ICAR's really, really funny about dealing with kids. And there are a few people in it, like November. There's a couple other people in the organization like do that I wouldn't have a problem with them dealing with. Personally, I don't even want to put myself in that position, I'll be honest with you. You know, it takes too long to build credibility up these days, and when you mess with kids, it's like the Emma Woods and David Jacobs things. One wrong word, you're fried. So it's a hard thing, because I know they need support, and I know they need help, and I know a lot of information comes from kids between the ages of 5 and 17. There's a lot of stuff going on in that particular age. But personally, I think it's easier to deal with the parents, explain to the parents, teach the parents, get the parents to understand this, introduce these parents to other parents with children that are having these experiences. And then they can all talk and the information, see, and then the researcher still gets to get the information that way, but the researcher doesn't have to put he or she self in a position that could cause them trouble down the line. And frankly, I'd be honest with you, if you're going to deal with kids in general, you should always make sure that the parents are present and at least two or three people that you trust are present. It's the same thing when you're doing hypnosis research. If you're a man and you're doing it with a woman, there should always be more than two parties involved. It's just, we live in a really strange world these days, and it's always better to be safe. So, you know, I'm funny about kids. I think we need to research them. I think it needs to be handled extreme. And you know the rules. We don't allow anyone under 18 inside the organization. It's not even allowed. And we don't even allow for positions until you're over 25 to even do anything in the organization. And you got to be 30 just to be a director. So you can see we're already...
Well, you know, we all know that just because you have an 18th birthday does not mean you magically have complete and total maturity and life experience and are ready to, you know, venture out into the world completely unaided. Yeah, that used to be why you really couldn't vote or anything else till you were 21. And today you still cannot buy alcohol till you're 21.
Well, can you blame them? Because you're an idiot at 18. Oh, I'm sorry if y'all are listening at 18. I was 18 once, too. I was an idiot, too, so don't take it the wrong way, which you really are. But to make a point, if any of y'all are familiar with Dr. Richard Boylan, you'll understand, if you go read his work, you'll understand why ICAR is as hard as it is about children and research. There's, like I said, there's only a few directors in the organization that I even trust to do it, so, and they're already either working with kids or quite familiar with working with children, so it's an easier and safer way to do that. Assign a few people that are good at it, that you know you can trust, that are not going to get themselves in any trouble, and leave it alone. It works great that way. Frankly, I don't have the patience for kids. That's why I only have one. I just don't.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the main things. I mean, I can say for myself and present company included on this panel that every piece of information I've ever received that has reportedly come from somebody under the age of 18, especially, you know, a young 5, 6, 7-year-old child, has come directly from their parents, you know, and in most cases, those parents are contactees also that have come to ICAR, you know, basically asking what to do, and we give similar advice to what we're giving now. I just have to, you know, say that everybody here is making good points and back up with the fact that, you know, a lot of the, you know, the whole alien abduction scenario, I mean, a lot of that is not child-appropriate material in the first place. I mean, quite frankly, I would backhand slap the piss out of anybody that decided to go to a kid and said, well, hey, have you read any of David Jacobs' books? Look, kid, you're about to start being raped by hybrids. I mean, that's just a big no-no right there.
Yeah, you know, and it does, I would say it takes a special investigator to handle talking with a kid. And just because the information comes from the parents does not mean it's not going to be colored. I know from dealing with parents and their offspring, all abductees, oftentimes the child's story is strained through the parent's perception, and then it's spoon-fed to you. And then, you know, in talking, it's like, well, no, they didn't really say that. That's what they meant. And, you know, you're kind of like, I don't think, you know, yeah, it becomes very difficult to try and get accurate information. Yeah, through the parents, because it is going to—it's secondhand information. It's hearsay. It's no different than somebody saying, "Well, my cousin Joe was abducted by aliens, and X, Y, and Z happened to him." You know, it's still hearsay. It's not—I don't think it's really got a lot of relevance.
Well, I think that's why an academic amnesty would be really important, and the amnesty issue with me in general. For the people that have definitely been warned by their superiors in military situations or in civilian situations that involve military personnel, and if they are granted the amnesty to be able to talk about issues that are no longer, you know, top-level national security, then you have to look at it and apply the same thing across the academic board so that the sociologists and social workers that would be trained to deal with this type of information would also have a peer review with a safety net so that they aren't basically kicked out of their careers for being involved in something because, you know, somebody that, you know, is a high-level marriage counselor thinks it's inappropriate, so they're going to consider the research spurious and then have them dragged through the mud.
Well, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say maybe ET themselves has something right about the way they seem to deal with children. One of the lines of research that we've followed at ICAR over the years seems it, you know, follows the general timeline of lifetime abductions. I mean, during early childhood, the extremely vast majority of childhood experiences are fairly innocuous. I mean, none of the children seem to remember any harsh medical procedures. There's nothing that seems to go out of their way to scare them. It's almost as if a lot of the experiences, you know, are borderline friendly or, you know, pretty much neutral and harmless in nature. That tends to slack off during adolescence. I guess from, you know, one of our theories about it is that, you know, during those important formative years, ET sort of backs off and lets you develop as, you know, a standard human being for a while. You know, I think a lot of researchers could take a lot off of that and, you know, more or less handle kids with, well, the same kid gloves. Ha ha, what a great pun, right?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You know, Joe, I know you had a bike cart, and what do you think the possibilities are, since no one else is taking the lead in trying to establish a review board, what do you think the chances are that ICAR could maneuver itself into a position where it at least is the catalyst to get one created?
Well, you know, it's interesting you brought that up because it's something I've been working on for about 2 years now. We're really, you know, I've been talking with my fellow ufologists and other organizations because this isn't going to work unless we can all do this together. It looks like if myself and Cliff Clifford, Stanton, and one other, which I'm not going to mention things we haven't talked about yet, would sign off on it, you would have the start of a peer review. My problem is when I talked with this with some of my friend ufologists, like Richard and Peter and a few others, they liked the idea, but they have the same problems that we all do. Is the board has to be so dynamic so that, you know, people aren't saying that it's just got its own agenda, because frankly, you know, ICAR has a different agenda than MUFON does. So if we're both sitting on the board, there's going to be a lot of data that simply isn't going to make it to the floor because we're not going to agree. On, especially when it comes to abduction research. There's just a lot of that stuff that we're not going to rubber stamp just because it's come across. But the same thing in UFO research, whereas other people may be stamping stuff that MUFON wouldn't want to bother with. So it's going to be interesting. I do think it is possible, not without lots of hair pulling, lots of teeth gritting, and frankly, lots of cussing and spitting, because I know these guys want to do it. But then, you know, Richard Dolan had a valid point when he said, you know, I'd love to do it, but then how much of my time is it going to take? Because, you know, he speaks and tours and writes. So, you know, how much time is it going to take? I mean, for me, I don't think it's going to be that complicated. We're not like we're going to review all of ufology. We just, any of the research that's coming in the field, good research that's coming in the field, or any research for that matter, should be submitted. But, you know, not everything is going to go before every ufologist, because, frankly, a lot of it's not going to need to. A lot of it's going to probably get shot down by a... We figure what we should have is like a sorting group ahead of the voting group, just because it's too much research, even for one group to take on. There's just too much of it. But if you're somebody in the field that's been established as a researcher and you're really wanting to get your research out there, this would be a fast way to do it. You submit it to the board, you get the top 10 or 12 ufologists in the field, the rubber stamp, and bam, everybody is going to pay attention to it. It don't matter who they are, they're going to pay attention to that research. And in the same way, if everybody puts their thumbs down, no one's going to pay attention to it. So that I think, is good. And like I said, it's going to take some effort, some fighting. It's just hard. And see, I cannot personally sit on the board, because it'll make trouble. Not me personally will make trouble, but the fact that I'm there will make trouble. So I was thinking one of our other directors, which we have several directors that would be well-suited to this job, that would really be fair, honest, and well-suited to this job. And that way they can't say, oh, Joe's shooting this one down, and Joe's shooting that one down because of personal interest, because really, it wouldn't be. But having MUFON there as well, you know, having MUFON, Cliff Clifford, or one of his number one, two, or threes up there, would really allow, it would also show that because there's two other organizations I'm talking to about this too. It would show that these four primary organizations in the field can get along and work together, which would do a lot for establishing outside harmony outside of the field, because that's another gripe I hear all the time. Well, y'all can't get along. Why should we even pay attention to you? You know,
it's so. Not like you're talking about peer-reviewing things and then throwing it out there for public opinion. You're talking about peer-reviewing it inside the... you know, groups within the organizations themselves, and then having to basically do what we would, in the layman's terms, call a focus group on a particular piece of evidence or a particular train of thought that one would follow given certain parameters. And so that in and of itself would probably be more beneficial for the organizations overall, and then that would formulate a better public opinion toward all of the organizations.
It would. It would foster better opinion. And to make this drive this point home, I don't know how many of y'all are familiar with the Source A stuff that was going all around, which is obviously BS. But the point I'm making here is if there would have been a review committee when this came out a year and a half ago, it would have got shot down in its first week. And we wouldn't have spent 2 years fighting, chatting, and arguing through ufology about what's going on there. But why don't we still have November back? What's up with that? Let's see. Anyway,
the tactic to take would be not necessarily have any of the big name people on the board.
Yeah,
but rather have a rotating review board that is anonymous from, say, a selection of 100 or 200 people located in various parts of the country.
Yeah, see, I think if you did that, you let the ufologists vote on them, I think they would go for that. Because then it's not about anybody's ego or anything. It's simply about the research. You know, you could do
yeah, and these review boards would meet, say, quarterly in various parts of the country. People don't have to travel so far. Not a big deal. You come, you talk to the review board, you tell them what you want to say. Bingo.
You know, another positive side effect about the whole review board thing, and, you know, I like the rotating idea, Georgia, but, I mean, one of the other interesting side effects of it would, you know, you'd be able to watch a particular ufologist or organization's voting record and basically see, you know, kind of where they stand on different things. That would be kind of, I think that would be a good idea.
Well, if you did it that way and say you had 20 people meet each time they're doing a review, they cast their vote. You, in order to get an A, you have to get more than 50%. Then it doesn't depend on any one person's opinion. You have to convince over 50% of these people that what you're doing is the right thing.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be.
Not that hard. It's pretty fair.
Oh, I think it would. I honestly think, November, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I honestly think it would be the way to go, but... Tell him this is going to be tough.
Because there's a lot of experienced people with a solid background in ufology that have zero interest in writing books and zero interest in being speakers, yet they are very competent in the field. They understand what's going on, what needs to happen. They may have various points of view, okay? You know, that, for example, you take six or eight of the people that I'm acquainted in the field with ufology. None of us are speakers. We all have been involved in the field a long time. We're pretty sane, but we got different points of view, okay? Some people are really into this channeling thing. Others are really into this light being thing, and some others are just into wanting physical evidence. But we all understand the concepts of producing solid information through a good method is much more important than what the opinion you come out with.
It is, too.
Yeah, right, we're basically talking about science versus science fiction, and there are too many people that are interested in the science fiction aspect and the fantasy aspect of UFO phenomenon into, you know...
It's really not even about science so much as the logic. You know, we're all going to be little Mr. Spocks, you might say. And, you know, we want to see the logic of where you're going with this. And if you can't show us a logical progression here with the method you want to use for this project, then you're going to get way more nays than you are A's. And, you know, that would be where you needed to take it, where you had to convince half the people, over half the people, that your method and your project had merit. And does it mean anything? Well, initially it won't mean a heck of a lot. But as you have more and more people come out with their books that say, my project was peer-reviewed by Ufology Congress, then, you know, that'd be a plus for them. And over time, I think it would become much more important than it would be initially.
It would certainly be an interesting experiment to watch play out, though. I know one of the pitfalls I kind of see in my mind, and you brought up a good point about it, Gio, was, you know, a lot of the nuts and bolts ufologists out there simply will not touch the whole abduction topic with a 10-foot pole. You know, and then again,
yeah,
the channelers
yeah.
are going to think
that... Well, hang on to those thoughts there, Jason. Folks, it's time for our break. Well, we're away from your computer. Check out our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Stay tuned, and the Dawn of Shades will return with more from our panel and our topics tonight.
So if you want want something sugar-coated?
Just buy a donut.
Each week we'll have an interesting guest, and I'll do psychic readings and dream interpretations with a psychic twist.
We touch on all that is paranormal, from exorcisms to ghost hunting.
From seances to passing spirits in a light.
Yeah, and sometimes Chris gets a little carried away.
But Stephanie's always there to reel me back in. We're making the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Tree Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcasts resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, Joe Montaldo. Right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Donna Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, with our panel of guests. And, well, once again, I would like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, and let me know what you think of it. You can find links to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you want to go straight to the blog, you can go to giascott.wordpress.com, and you can find out what kinds of things I'm up to lately. Now, tonight's topic is a fascinating one, and many of you may like to ask a question or make a comment. You can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com, and I am monitoring the email during the program. You can call in at 504-273-7379. Once again, that number is 504-273-7379. Or if you're listening in on a podcast or think of it after the program has finished, go ahead and email it to me. I'll do my best to get your questions answered. If you're in the virtual auditorium, you can always put it in the text there, and I'm trying very hard to catch through the screen scrolls. Now, just before we went to break, we were talking about peer reviews. We've actually been continuing that debate while we've been on break here. You know, what do you think the chances are that we are going to manage to get one put together in the next 2 years of any kind? Anybody want to answer?
I was going to, but I had to start laughing.
I don't see it happening.
I wouldn't know better than that. As much as I wanted, I have to agree with November. I would have to say that
we would have to jump over the first big question that we would get from some of the bigger people in ufology, which is the question, what's in it for me? And once they get over the answer to that, which is nothing, then we could proceed forward with putting something like it together.
Yeah, you would actually have to choose a more convincing tactic than nothing. It's actually maybe won't affect people such as Stanton Friedman and a lot of these other people that have been around for my entire life, practically. It's not going to affect them much. But it is going to affect the next generation. It's going to affect the people who are under 40 now in a much bigger way than it's going to affect most of the people who are over 40. It's going to affect the next generation of ufologists even more than it affects the ones that are working now. Now, is there an immediate benefit for the first few years of reviews? Probably not, because that review board has got to establish their own reputation. There's going to be a lot of sticky stuff in deciding who picks the people to be on this rotating review board. And I would say you would have to go to the largest groups involved in research now and have them each submit a percentage of the candidates for the review board. And there again, it's a rotating review board. You might meet somebody entirely different on the West Coast than you do the East Coast, or in the North than the South. And that's okay. That's why you have a board of 10 or 20 people, and you only have to convince half of them. But, you know, I could see where it's got validity, but I can also see a lot of problems with getting it started. But somebody has got to bite that bullet first and push to create it.
And one of the potential problems that I see is, you know, take a hot-button issue in ufology today. Like, let's go ahead and use the whole Jerusalem UFO as an example. I mean, then again, what happens if, you know, the review board makes their vote and they come out in something like a 49-51 split? You know, something that's so close that, you know, given somebody, one particular member's mood might have made all the difference in something being, you know, the seal of approval or, you know, more or less dismissed. You know, I mean, I can certainly see how there are a lot of potential problems that could be with it. You know, and what happens when the review board comes out against something that, you know, one of the preeminent big old names in ufology out there comes, you know, has something to say. I mean, I could certainly see something like, well, who the hell is this little review board? You know, I'm Bud Hopkins, damn it. They don't count.
Well, there again, like I said, you know, some of these people that have been around for many people that are currently up and coming, you might say, been around for their entire life. This board is not going to affect them. It is going to affect the next generation. It's going to have to be the creation of the current generation. And it's going to take someone with a lot of charisma, a lot of convincing arguments, and the ability to deal with multiple egos. Because, you know, it really is an important thing. But at the same time, we've devoted half a program to that. We do have some other topics that we need to touch on about ufology today. And November, I know you have something you want to ask.
I do. Oh, my gosh, I'm echoing. Sorry, guys.
That's
I have
okay.
No idea what's going on. Okay, it seems to stop. Here's my question, listening, and maybe they've had an experience. Maybe they're sitting in China or India or, I don't know, somewhere in Africa. And maybe they're thinking, you know what, I would like to be involved in some way. I mean, it doesn't have to be anything grandiose or anything like that, but this is kind of interesting. I would like to see what kind of information comes out of my contribution to the ufology subject. And I have an answer to it myself, but I wanted to know, what would you guys suggest to these people who are sitting here listening, saying, you know, this all sounds really interesting. What can I do?
So what kinds of things can people do?
I think
how can a person get involved and be a contributing member of the ufology community without becoming a writer, a speaker, et cetera?
I think one of the obvious answers, one of the most obvious answers to that is basically to find a group like ICAR or another reputable abduction researcher and basically get your experiences out there and add them to the knowledge base.
Well, again, this goes back to, and I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, the whole thing with amnesty and what are we as the researchers going to do to provide some sort of an umbrella for people so that there's not a stigma attached to it? I mean, for me, that's the big thing with a lot of people is, you know, I would talk about this, but I don't want to talk to anybody that's not an experiencer, or I don't want to talk to an investigator. I want to talk to other experiencers, and I've seen that variation as well. And to say that, you know, there are people in ICAR that are not necessarily the directors, you know, or actual investigators themselves. And I think that's going to have to be like a grassroots effort to, you know, start engaging people.
So how can we get more grassroots? Go ahead, November. I didn't hear you.
Was it me? Can I answer my own question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so because I've been sitting here thinking about this, you guys brought up something like this on the break, and I was thinking, you know, the responses I've got from people that want to be involved, a lot of them just want to have their experience involved. They don't necessarily want their name, their title, their occupation, all these types of things involved. They don't mind giving you a location where they live. They don't mind giving you detailed information, but they really don't. They don't want their name out there for public consumption. So really, somebody who's sitting there thinking that, you know, I would really like to be able to participate in some way, I'm going to plug my own projects, you can go to the ICAR network. There are 3 or 4 open projects over there right now, and simply provide the information. When I'm doing it, a lot of people will provide their name, their email, and everything else, but I never give out that information. And they also have to remember to be patient. When somebody opens up a project, you're looking at 6 months to a year to actually complete it, because you got to have time to gather the information, to do the research, you know, to offer perceptions. Then the person doing it, because we don't get no money for any of this, they have to go about finding somebody who's going to edit their project, who might, find people to bounce information off, that type of thing. And I would really like to see more of a global participation, although I am seeing it, but it would be interesting to even see that more broad range. That's my answer to my question.
Yeah, you know, and getting contributing your information to these studies is important. There's lots of things that can be done. A lot of people are really, really concerned that their involvement in ufology, even as a volunteer, not as a speaker or a writer themselves, but as a volunteer participating, attending conferences, expressing an interest publicly in the field, is going to cost them their job, is going to cause them to be publicly ridiculed, is going to cause them to lose faith. And so they'll back away from it and want to stay in the background out of sight, while at the same time they have this intense need to know on their part. Do you guys think that really in today's world that expressing an interest, not coming out as an abductee or an experiencer, just expressing an interest in ufology and related topics is going to have that severe repercussions for someone that's a professional today?
Well, even just being involved for about a dozen years in the field myself, I've seen an awful lot of changes in that respect. Because when a lot of us first got involved with this, I mean, there was really no outlet, you know, no place to go to other than people who, you know, were specifically involved in the ufology business and made that, you know, their bread and butter. I mean, you know, thinking about 12 years ago, I mean, there weren't, you know, a huge amount of documentaries. There was no UFO hunters. There was no ancient aliens. I mean, there weren't, you know, you couldn't turn on your TV and, you know, basically find a UFO or alien-related documentary on some channel. I mean, I certainly think a lot of things have changed. I mean, it certainly is not to the point where, you know, anybody would feel comfortable, you know, saying, hey, look, I'm an abductee, but I certainly think that, yeah, you know, as far as expressing interest, it has become a whole lot more mainstream than it was in the recent past.
November, let's hear from you. Maybe not. Maybe she's not there.
Who?
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, let's go. Pardon?
Are you talking about me?
Yeah, your name's November, I think.
Yeah, it is. What was the question? I'm highly distracted today. I have no idea why. I'm sorry.
The question is, really, when expressing an interest, not coming out as an abductee or experiencer yourself, but expressing an interest in the field of ufology, have repercussions in someone's professional life today?
I think the perception...
Should we be worried about losing their job?
Right.
Do they need to worry about any of that?
Can you see me sticking my tongue out at you? I think that the perception that it's going to have some kind of impact is more prevalent than it actually having an impact. And there are people that know what I do, and they think it's kind of cool. I mean, you know, there was a long time that that perception of mine of having some kind of impact would have prevented me from talking, you know, to, you know, people about what I do. Now, it doesn't really bother me so much. However, I do take it with, if somebody brings it up, then I'll talk about it. But I don't, you know, I don't go sit in a lunchroom and say, hey, let's talk UFOs, you know, that type of thing. But I do have people that will just, even just complete strangers, oddly enough, that will walk up and ask me questions. And I'm going, okay, I don't really have UFO written on my forehead as a neon light, but they must have picked up something. And I don't mind talking about it like that, but I'm not going to go out there and, you know, put a sandwich board on or anything like that. So I would think, no, I don't think so. I think it's the perception that it's going to have an impact. And it really might depend also what part of the world you live in, what part of the United States that you live in. You know, your territory as far as, you know, what the prevailing winds are is what people believe that might have an impact.
Okay. Gregory, we're going to go with you next.
Well, I think that people have been destigmatized over the last 10 years through the advent of the thing we're using now, internet technology. And I look, you know, myself back at, you know, the idea that 60 years ago when we had a newspaper report at Roswell about a UFO crash. It became a sensational item over the news players at that time. And here we have people using handheld phones broadcasting live earthquake damage, political unrest, upheaval, you know, United Nations police actions that fall short of the definition of war. And not to mention other revolutions. And that's being, you know, subversive enough in the eyes of the powers that be. So I don't think that stigmatizing people based on their interest in a particular subject matter is anywhere close that it would have been back in the days of the McCarthy era with, you know, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And I just hope that the UFO research field doesn't degenerate into a situation where it's, are you or have you ever been abducted by just the Greys and the Greys alone? And I think that as long as we avoid a situation like that, that people will be more forthcoming and be a little bit more voluntary on being involved. I just think that we have to provide people with a grassroots type of connection so that they don't think that their neighbors out in the street that they're going to run into at the PTA meeting thinks that they are the guy in the chicken suit with the sandwich board running around squawking about something, and that he does deserve to lose his job. And if it's looked upon as a non-negative, I think then we've accomplished a lot with that. I think technology is going to help us get over that hump.
Well, you know,
okay.
If I could add to that.
Hang on, Jason. Joe, I want to hear from you now.
Well, I'm gonna let Jason get in and add on to it. I don't know. It's for me, it's hard because, and when we started in this field, we were nobodies that were talking about ufology. With, you know, I may have been in the field longer than a lot of the people who were talking with right now, but still, you know, it started out as a bunch of friends chatting, you know, with a novice interest, you know, with one or two investigators that were involved. And it seemed like back in 2000, late 90s, it was somewhat acceptable to the population. So if it's weird to me because I've seen this over the course of a generation, like the 40s, late 40s, early 50s, this was a great thing to talk about. Then the mid 50s up to about the mid 60s, it was a nightmare. Then it was kind of good for the hippies, and then back into the 70s, again, it was good. Now we're back to where it's bad. It goes back and forth. But since I've been alive, like in 76, this was a socially acceptable topic matter. In 66, this was a socially acceptable topic matter. In 52, this was. It just, for some reason, we flip-flap back and forth. So if you're just your average everyday person who's walking up and looking at this or wants to get involved in this or has an interest that thinks it may get involved in this, It's going to be harder and easier. It's going to be easier in the fact that we have the internet and anybody can post anything and anybody can go to a blog or a radio show or start a radio show or start a blog and start spewing information. But is it going to be accepted by people like us? No. We're going to ignore it unless we see some kind of credible research behind it or credible information behind it, or if the person shows that their self has credibility, then we might accept it. But the hardest part of this whole field is establishing some sort of credibility, which we work at every day. I mean, we work hard at it every day, and it's hard to keep any kind. So if you're somebody coming in new, you have to deal with all of that stuff. So I think in some ways it would be easy for someone off the street just to walk into the field and make some changes. In other ways, I don't think they're going to be able to affect anything because they're going to have to go against the harder and bigger egos. I got to be honest with you, G, you know this. You were here at the start. If it wouldn't have been for a group, we would have never made it. They would have shut us down years ago. But we were coming from so many different sides, and then when we added the radio station, it made it almost impossible to stop us from what we were doing. But if they could have, and I got to be totally honest with anybody listening tonight, if this is ufology in general, if they could have stopped us, the organization and the station, they would have.
Well, this brings back to a point. I mean, you're dead on there, because there was a point in time that we actually pulled more people on Yahoo chat than Coast to Coast was able to pull with their own room, and it almost got us kicked off of there.
And it's a good point, because we were being attacked and kicked off. Because what's right now, if you go type in UFO radio or paranormal radio, you're going to notice that this network is 1, 2, or 3. Right now in the paranormal, we're 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. On the UFO, we're 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Actually, we're beating out Coast to Coast, but that flip-flops back and forth every day. So, yes, we're an aggravation and a threat. We have our own venues to put out our own information, and we have good researchers. So, it took the two organizations to get us there. There's no one person in this organization could ever say they got us to this point. It is legitimately a group effort that got us to where we are today. So that's why I think it's going to be really hard for anybody walking inside, because they've got to fight through all of the idiots, the ones that don't want anybody new in the field. I mean, let's be honest, they don't like the idea. See, like November, between her and I, we're introducing a lot of information last year and this year, and it's making a lot of people happy, but it's making a lot of people mad. Because, you know, they're like, well, they're just going to change ufology to it. Well, no, we're doing research. We're actually doing legitimately based research so that y'all can see why we have the opinions that we have, which is more than I can say about most organizations and people out there. But it's a hard fight, because, like I said, some of them want us, some of them don't. And I think for a new person coming in, it's going to be the exact same thing. They got to get past the organization. See, we're more open. We're willing to take new applications. We're looking for directors and investigators and stuff, but the other organizations aren't. They're very tight-knit. They're very close. They're looking for members, but they're not looking for anybody to interfere in the overall operation of their organizations, which is a no-no, because, frankly, they're all living in the past. So, anyway, I'm going to shout about that if I get myself in real trouble.
Well, you know,
all right, Jason, you had something you wanted to add, so let you yap again.
All right. Now, going back to a lot of the stigma that's attached with, you know, showing any kind of interest in the UFO field, you know, I have to be frank here and admit that, quite frankly, a lot of the valid criticisms that somebody may have against somebody who's interested in the whole UFO and alien topic, quite frankly, they come from the topic themselves. I mean, come on, people. When you've got stuff like AllNewsWeb saying, hey, look at this amazing UFO video, and you can tell it's a damn balloon floating across the sky. Or you hear about something when it's slightly more balloon-related, like, oh, you're into UFOs, so are you like that balloon boy idiot? You know, or you, like, do a Google search for alien encounters, and you start seeing a lot of, like, the peace and love and light, and, oh, look, I'm channeling Plethar from the Astral Command, and our space brothers are up there saying that, look, all you have to do is believe like us, and we'll end all of your problems down on Earth, because we're your space brothers and we're watching out for you. You know, yeah, I can honestly see why there is somewhat of a stigma, because quite frankly, there is a lot of crap out there. And Joe, as you and Greg alluded to just a moment ago, you know, ICAR is one of the places, ICAR and people like us are one of the places and things that can do something about that. I mean, I'm simply astonished by one of the things I've come across as an abduction researcher is I've come across an extreme, probably two out of three people that I talk to about their abduction experiences relate a similar story to me about, you know, I went and I found an online chat group, or I went to a local support group, and they proceed to inform me that they're like, look, the stuff those people were talking about had absolutely not a damn thing to do with what I've experienced, and quite frankly, it's a breath of fresh air to talk to you and ICAR and have somebody take me seriously and not try to feed me a line of crap. I mean, if there's anything that we can do in the field is, well, we can provide that higher standard.
Well, you know, I know that as an observer, when we're talking about, you know, expressing an interest in the field, if you post on bulletin boards, if you, anything you do on the internet, you can hit a search engine with your name and all those things are going to come up. And that's a concern for people that are hunting for a job sometimes. But is it a legitimate concern? Do people really care what your hobby is? Maybe to a degree. Can this interest be used against you? Certainly. I know of a case, I believe it's about a year ago now, in which a man lost custody and visitation rights to his underage child because of his interest in ufology. Is that common? No. Could it have been prevented? Possibly. He represented himself. He knew that this information was going to be used against him by his ex-spouse. You know, if he had hired a lawyer to represent him, maybe he'd have come out better. Maybe not, because he happens to be in Mississippi in a small town, court, small town judge, and he didn't do well. Is that normal? No. It's the only case I have heard of in the last 5 years in which something so dramatic occurred simply because a person had interest in the field. I've known a lot of other people that were afraid to express that interest because of their jobs, but I have never heard of anyone losing their job over it. I've heard of people getting razzed. Hey, you know, being razzed is like being offended. Nothing happens. You know, you're going to live through it. That's the thick skin thing, you know. If you're really and truly sincerely involved in ufology, you're probably going to develop a thick skin relatively quickly. And that's true anytime you start appearing in the public eye, because people do look for any flaw. Christina Aguilera did the national anthem. She made a mistake in the lyrics, substituted one word for another. It's been everywhere on the internet. Okay, she's fairly well established in the music industry. The national anthem is fairly well known. She should have known the words. You know, yeah. It's just, you know, it's one of those things. If you're in the public eye, you are going to get some ridicule. If you make a single mistake, even in one word, everybody is going to point the finger at you. That's human nature, I guess. So what are the other big major issues facing ufology today?
Honesty is one of them.
Honesty,
Well, let's look at the internet. How much of the internet information is actually true? You know, I asked this to Stanton Friedman one time. He just started laughing. And because no one actually knows, that's why he started laughing. I can tell you this. While we've been chatting, you know, I had to go get my pizza up, but while we were chatting, I was just doing a search, just basic. I went on Yahoo. I just typed in UFO. Started on, because, you know, page one and two is basically just promo BS anyway. Started looking. Out of the 30 sites I clicked on, maybe one of them might be worth reading. The rest of them are just somebody's opinions written down on the internet and put up there, which is fine, but I just think they should have to say that, you know, for the novice people coming in. They should have to say, hey, it's my opinion. Because I got to say, these internet sites read like facts. And, of course, they're not facts. And so truth for me is going to be one of the big issues in the upcoming year. And it's one of the things I'll be pushing anyway to get people to be more honest, I guess. But it's hard to get some of the BS out of the field.
Well, I think we touched on this a little bit the other night where we were talking about the medical companies are actually doing research into whether or not you should be allowed to go onto a website and post comments about issues that you had experiencing side effects with their medications. And then the legislation that's being proposed to be drawn up is that the medicine companies have to basically pay to police the comments that people are going to make in public about the side effects and things, and to basically go around almost like Big Brother and, you know, you said this about the such and such pill, and we're going to take all your comments off Facebook because you're not allowed to do that because your comment wasn't approved by XYZ drug company. And I don't really want to see the UFOlogy go down that road, where what we were talking about with the peer review panel becoming something like that type of a policing state. And I agree with the virtual auditorium, where we police ourselves.
Yeah, taking Joe's tactic with searching, okay? I used Bing. I typed in alien abductions, and I went to page 3. On page 3 was an article from eHow.com on how to identify alien abduction. It gives, number 1, contemplate is unaccountable for a period of time. Number 2, examine your body for unidentifiable scratches or scoop marks. Number 3, determine if you have nosebleeds or unexplained blood spots on your sheets. Number 4, if you've seen UFOs recently or sometime during your lifetime. Number 5, are other members of your family abducted? Number 6, if your clothing or any other items in your house are ever in disarray for no reason. And number 7, contemplate your dreams. Okay, that's the 7 criteria that we give on eHow. But on the sidebar, top 5 to try. This is where it gets interesting. How to prevent alien abductions. How to get abducted by aliens on The Sims 2. How to write credible alien abduction stories. Number 4, how to get alien abduction insurance. And number 5, how to visit alien abduction sites. Now, I have not clicked on any of those, so I don't know what kind of information is there. But, when one of the biggest problems I see as an investigator and researcher is the time that's wasted on the crap, people who are really, they're lying about the abduction experiences, they are trying to deceive the abduction community. It's the flying saucers and pie plates in the sky, it's the balloons on the fishing line, it's that kind of stuff that really, really causes problems. Use waste time trying to verify whether or not a picture is in fact a hoax, only to discover you spent X number of hours on a hoax and now you're ticked off. In addition, these hoaxes are well covered by the mass media, whereas a legitimate sighting is not. So everybody's perception is all these sightings or events are hoaxes because that's what they see in the news. So these hoaxes cost the UFO community, the ufology community, the abduction community, all these areas of research. It costs them an incredible amount in terms of time and money, because time is money. So what are y'all feelings on that?
Well, there you kind of have to take a look at the divide between, spectators out there in the public that are bored and just, want to take a look at an interesting issue and find out some information about it. And you have to contrast that with the people who have had experiences that simply can't rationalize them away. I'd have to say that in my research, and I'm sure most of you have come to the same conclusions, that the people that have had the legitimate experiences, they know better. They know not to fall from the crap, and the vast majority of them simply don't buy a lot of the hype and a lot of the BS that's out there. Now, once you get into the general public and the people looking for a quick entertainment fix, I don't know if there's anything that can really be done about that.
Well, you could do a top 100 list of websites and top 100 list of researchers and stuff like that, just to cut down on some of it. I don't know how you get. I mean, literally, what are they, like 33 million websites for this? I mean, it's crazy. It's just insane. I mean, the other day I did something. I went out to like page 2800 or something just to see what the hell was there. And a lot of it's just repeat from earlier stuff. still, man. You find a new stuff as you go through it, as you go through it. So the main reason I want to board is because I feel for two reasons. One, I feel like some of the people we've been talking about, some of the people trying to get started are not getting recognized. I mean, I call it new people because we're actively looking and seeking new people, but still, we miss a lot of people. If there was a review board, at least a lot of these new people would be submitting information. It would help organizations find membership. It would help organizations find good researchers. It would also help the researchers find good information and put good information out. I can't see where it's a bad thing other than the ego problem when everybody's ego is getting in the way. I can't see how this is going to be bad for us because, frankly, if we'd had this 10 years ago, we'd be 10 years more advanced than we are now because we could have got through that much BS. But think about it. We've had a whole squad of us sifting information, ancient history, you name it. We're still sifting it. And it would be just nice to be able to cheat and have somebody sifting some of it for us. But I guess it's just a fantasy.
I just think it's a little ironic that we could discuss having a board of people that have to sign a non-disclosure agreement in order to get disclosure on the UFOs.
Well, you got to have this non-disclosure. I don't know why MUFON has non-disclosure. I know why ICAR does. ICAR has it to protect its contactees. I couldn't tell you why. MUFON does it to protect their profit margin. We do it to protect our contactees. Because they don't really have anything over there they need to keep secret. I mean, they can say it's personal information, but you can submit UFO reports fairly anonymous and still get a lot of information. Contactees don't work that well. Anonymous contactees are fine, but they don't really do anything to support the overall movement. So you need people who are willing to step forward. So it's different in that aspect anyway.
I think information should be made available to people that participate in the studies when the information submitted by the other people is submitted anonymously, so we don't have the stigmatization problem with, you know, the accumulation of information from the people. We don't end up creating another issue.
It's hard to get a balance between disclosing information and retaining enough information that research can continue without people having excess information to perpetuate a hoax, without releasing too much information, because people really don't need to know who the cases are in all cases. If we're disclosing the names of contactees that have participated in an investigation, they're going to be much less likely to participate to begin with.
Well, you know, a lot of the experiencers themselves kind of take care of that problem by, you know, proactively not getting a lot of information out there. I mean, a lot of the contactees that I talk to, I mean, I more or less have a good idea of who they are. You know, I know most of their life story or as much as that they wanted to tell me, but you know, as far as anything officially identifiable goes, I mean, a lot of these people might not even tell me their names. You know, even some people that I've known for the past dozen years or so. You know, as far as they're willing to go out on that limb is, you know, a witty internet chat name with a front profile with absolutely no information on it. I mean, the whole point of it isn't to get somebody's social security. It's just basically to get a general idea of the experiences that these people have had and enough statistical information to categorize them into a particular group. Now, one of the other questions that this was just something that was on my mind, but what do you guys think about the future of ufology? I mean, that next generation of ufologists out there. I'd have to say that, I don't know, it's kind of depressing to take a look out there. It seems like a lot of the, you know, new wave, next-gen people that consider themselves ufologists, to me, they're more or less amateur journalists with opinions in a blog. I mean, are y'all seeing a lot of the same problem with that, too?
I think a lot of times it boils down to maturity. When you're in your teens and your 20s, there's a level of interest, but not necessarily life experience to really productively direct that interest. And as you enter your 30s, that you really start to have that life experience, that maturity, all the things that really you need in order to channel that interest into becoming a proactive ufologist itself. you know, in terms of joining the organization and getting involved, you really, I mean, we don't see that much of it in the under 30 group. You know, you just don't, you know, even the ones that we know, they may participate in an investigation, they may participate in occasional things, but they don't have the sustained interest that drives you through the slogging through paperwork, the pain in the butt BS that we have to do every single day in order to keep websites functioning, in order to keep organizations functioning, in order to keep radio programs like this and all the others that PRN puts out. All that requires a very sustained effort by a group of people, mm-hmm. and how many of them are under 30?
See, that's a damn good point there, Gia, because actually in this group, none of them are under 30. Now, let me correct myself. ICAR has a large group, a large membership under 30, probably out of all the organizations, we're probably the largest. But how many of them are active participants of the organization? I don't think I want to say on the air.
Well, you know, I just know from when we've done panels before, when we've done interviews before, we can get a few voices in the under 30 group to speak up.
Yeah.
But in general, no. They're focused on the things that they need to do for themselves, you know, in terms of education and getting started in their jobs and starting families and relationships and all that kind of stuff. And it's not until you're more settled in your 30s, when you reach that different stage in your life, that you have that energy that's left over that you can channel not only into ufology, but it's really into any thing like ufology. They may have it for their jobs, but until they're in their 30s, they don't have it for volunteers and, you know, all that other stuff. You know, I see it in my own daughter. You know, she's participated in a few panels in the past with a few other ICAR things. Jason, we've known you a very, very long time, and you were barely over 20 when all this started. But it took a long time for you to develop focus that was sustained. Because occasionally something shiny and catch your eyes, and off you go, chasing that, whatever. But that, you know, we've seen that with not that many under 30 people are going to get actively involved on a continuing basis. And it's probably not until they're 40 that you start seeing really sustained effort. And I'm talking statistically. There's always exceptions. But statistically, most of the people that are active, that devote an incredible amount of time or waste an incredible amount of time, that we start seeing some more sustained effort.
Well, I think in defense of some of the youngins out there, well, I know in my case, as you mentioned, there was a long period of time where I simply did not know enough about my experiences or anybody else's experiences or the topic in general that, well, it took me a while before I considered myself somewhat ready for prime time. I mean, I still ask myself that question, you know, rather frequently. I know, there's hope out there. There's hope out there. I mean, give some of the younger researchers time to, well, yeah. A little bit of maturity does help. Now, sometimes I still have a few problems with that myself.
You know, in the virtual auditorium, it was mentioned that there's a lot of newbies that want a quick UFO fix to get their answers right now. And that occurs with all age groups. Maybe it is more common in the younger age groups. You know, with life experience, we learn that things don't happen quickly, no matter how much we want them to.
Well, we're looking at information being available, and 12 years ago, the amount of information really still wasn't available on a person-to-person level. Look at the exponential growth in the number of Internet users. It went from 600,000 people on the World Wide Web to over a billion. So when we're talking about destigmatizing a certain subject, it's almost as if, you know, and not to compare ufology to organized religion again, but you look at society's general exception to people from different religious backgrounds intermarrying and things, and you know it's taken a long time just for something like that, and you know, for something to have been guffawed like the UFO phenomenon for so long, it may take another generation for that particular stigma to go away.
It's going to take a lot for the stigma to go away, and it will take time. Programs like Ancient Aliens, UFO programs, you know, all of these topics that we see on television, they're doing a lot to desensitize people. You know, are we going to see disclosure in our lifetime? I'm not worried about disclosure. I don't know about you guys, but I kind of, all this disclosure stuff, no, it's not happening. I'm not going to worry about it.
Well, you see, that's the point there. It's already happened, ladies and gentlemen. Disclosure happened a long, long time ago with the Sumerians and the Dogon and the Egyptians and the Aborigines and the Mesoamericans. Apparently, our society, since the last 2,000 years, can't handle this, so we undisclosed it from ourselves. Then to top it all off, ET only really cares if the contactees know. So as far as they're concerned, everybody who needs to know knows. That's why I don't know. Every time I hear someone say disclosure, I'm like, who's going to disclose? ET? No. They don't want to disclose anymore. They've disclosed to everybody they want to. If the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is if ET wanted you to know, they would go fly over the top of the White House, sit there for a couple of days, and everybody in the world would know they were there. No. They're only interested in the contactees knowing. That's all they're really interested in. And the government wants to keep it a secret because they want to keep what they find for themselves. So there is no need for disclosure, and if you're not a contactee, there's no real need for disclosure because they're not doing anything to you. So what does it matter? The contactees have
the
right
to know. Talking with younger
abductees,
yeah. That's exactly what they say. They have no desire to talk to non abductees about their experiences.
Yeah.
It basically boils down to it's none of their business. They're not involved.
Yeah, and that's the way it is. Contactees are funny like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you do see a lot of people take, you know, the whole contactee idea and sort of wrap some, you know, pseudo-religious ideas around it. God, I hate talking bad about people, but, I mean, there's an awful lot about that, an awful lot around that. I mean, in particular, like, some of the, some of the more spiritual, religious types of, you know, non-physical contact, I mean, it does tend to turn a lot of people off that they're kind of like, you know, an us against them crowd. That, hey, look, we're enlightened. All you other poor plebeians are just SOL.
You know, I just seem to, I want to make a comment because I just seen something go across the virtual auditorium. One of our friends is getting hypnotically regressed. I'm going to tell you a little secret for your own safety. One, before you get regressed, set up the line of question. In other words, it should be something like, the first time they talk to you, it should be something like, hey, what happened on this date at this time? Can you tell me the whole experience and then tell it backwards? Then you stop and form a line of questioning from that doesn't use words like ET or extraterrestrials or spacecraft or any of that stuff. But also, you bring someone with you for the entire session that you trust implicitly. Someone you would trust with your life. That's who you want to have with you doing a hypnotic regression in the session. If you don't do those things, the session is totally and absolutely useless. Doesn't matter what anybody else says, that is the standard of evidence. So if you don't do it that way, it's a useless thing. It can be argued down as dreams or guided or anything along those lines.
Hypnotist to extract the information from you correctly without leading you, without coloring your responses, without feeding you false information, and so forth and so on. So, you know, choosing your hypnotist is very, very important, and their ability to interrogate an abductee, it really needs to be considered. You need to know how many others they've done, what kind of experience they have in the field.
CF, don't worry about it. I was just recently told I'm in charge of all military abductions in the United States. I'll take you off the list. How's that? I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. I can't help it. It's the third time in a week somebody told me that myself, ICAR, and several of my close friends and allies or generals in the military abduction thing. Come on, people. Can you give me a break here?
Well, at least they think you're very, very important, Joe. I would have never put you in as a general.
Hey, look, I'm not even a general. I'm the guy over the generals. I don't even know what the hell that is.
Yeah,
whatever. Yeah, they said Jason and Sam and a few other people they brought up. And it was all over Facebook for a couple of days, and then it was on MySpace, and I seen it on somebody's tweet the other day. And, of course, I'm not really mad about it. I think it's kind of funny because, you know, I'm well-established in the field. But when I was talking, I wrote a letter to Melinda Leslie after the show the other night, and I said, you better watch it, Melinda. I'm sending them for you, baby. You're going to be Mill Labs. Let me tell you this much. If I was in charge of Mill Labs, it would be a whole different scenario. So just know that and be grateful I'm not. You would not like it, trust me. Oh, are we? Oh, Gia, take us out. I didn't really, I'm glad you said something. Yeah, we're at the top of the hour, ladies and gentlemen. So we'll let Gia take us out of here.
Folks, we have already run out of time. I would like to thank everyone for joining us tonight and being such a fantastic panel. We're going to have to do this again. I've enjoyed the program with them tonight, and I hope all of you have as well, and that you found that it provided you with plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next Tuesday, and we'll bring you another episode of The Dawn of Shades. Sure to be another fascinating conversation with our guests, as well as our anniversary program. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.